Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. Today, I am happy to share with you one of my favorite conversations I've had with a musician in years. Steve Earle, the one and only Steve Earle, came to the Fretboard Journal offices here in Seattle. He was doing a little press tour for his excellent new record, Guy, which is a tribute record to the one and only Guy Clark. Came here, we chatted about Guitar Geek stuff for over an hour, and I had so much fun talking to him. I think you will love it, and I encourage everyone to check out this new record because it is truly fantastic. I feel like this is the start of a much longer conversation with Steve Earle. We are definitely going to get him in the pages of our magazine and perhaps, like Guy Clark, on the cover of our magazine very soon. So consider this your introduction to the guitar geek world of Steve Earle if you are not familiar with it. Before I get to that conversation, we have a new sponsor today for the Fretboard Journal podcast that I am very excited about. Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Mono. True story. Some of you know this, some of you who follow me on Instagram. I built a parts caster earlier this year. It is very close to my heart. It doesn't look like much. It's a bit of a mongrel, but some of my favorite people in the world helped me assemble it. It has bits and pieces on it that tell a little bit of my life story, and it means a ton to me. It is my favorite guitar right now. When I first assembled this thing and knew I was going to put it together, I thought, I need a gig bag for it. So what did I do? I went on to Amazon and bought the absolute cheapest Telecaster-sized gig bag that I could find. I have used that gig bag exactly once. Fast forward a little bit, I eventually picked up a Mono Vertigo electric guitar case. It's lightweight, it fits my back like a glove. Clearly it's built to last, and there is even a slick little pocket in the back that fits my laptop securely and perfectly. And guess what? This case actually has me playing guitar more. I didn't think a case could do this. But I take my little Telecaster everywhere I go. I take it to work. I take it home after work. I've taken it on trips. I find myself playing my favorite guitar a hell of a lot more just because this thing is so versatile and so useful. I never thought a case could have that kind of effect on me, but it does. And I am so happy that Mono has decided to sponsor the Fretboard Journal podcast, as well as a lot of other things we're going to be up to later this year. So thanks to Mono. Check out their cases if you haven't yet over at monocreators.com. They do a lot more than cases too. They have backpacks, they have pedal boards, they have all sorts of cool stuff that you will love. And if you do reach out to them, by all means, tell them thank you for supporting the Fretboard Journal podcast. Before we get to my interview with Steve Earle, a couple of quick announcements. We also shot a video of Steve performing LA Freeway, Guy Clark's amazing tune, here at the Fretboard Journal. Check that out on fretboardjournal.com. And if you haven't subscribed yet, you can do so now, either in the print version or we are selling now digital subscriptions, discounted PDF versions of the Fretboard Journal for a full year. You can do that at fretboardjournal.com. Our 44th issue is actually mailing out this week, so if you subscribe quickly, you'll get it within about 2 weeks. And if you are an existing subscriber, you're going to want to start camping out near your mailbox later this week or early next week, depending on where you live. All right, here is our talk with Steve Earle. I hope you enjoy it. Steve, thanks for being here.
It's good to be here.
So obviously I want to talk about the Guy Clark record, but we've been geeking out about guitars.
Yeah.
And Guy is one of the few people we've talked to who actually made his own guitars.
Yeah, he made really good guitars too.
Were you able to, do you have
I
one?
I don't have one. Oh, I'm one of the only people that was close to him that doesn't have one. Daryl has one, Rodney has one, Sean Camp has one. I don't have one.
You and he obviously went way back. You were bass playing for him when, how old were you? Like,
I'm 19. Yeah. When I met him, I guess I was 20 by the time I actually played bass with him on that tour. Yeah, because I celebrated my 21st birthday the last night of a 6-night run at Castle Creek, and when right after Old Number One came out. Wow. So, you know, I got there. I knew Towns already, that gave me an introduction to Guy. Rodney moved to the West Coast after I'd been there about 8 or 9 months to play with Emmy's band, mm-hmm. which made me the kid. And the kid did two things. Among the kid's responsibilities were to play bass if Guy decided to put a group together, which he didn't do that often. The first record still wasn't out, you know. And or and talk to Susanna when he wasn't talking. You know, wasn't he mad? He just didn't talk sometimes. And Susanna would call you up and go, "Come get me." And it was Rodney's gig before me, and then it was mine. But you know, it was a real live apprenticeship. He took a real interest in not just me, Rodney before me, you know, other people after that, Sean Camp years later, mm-hmm. until he, you know, until he passed away. Sean's like, he was always fascinated with him. You know, Sean Camp's one of the best players that I know of, period, in any kind of music. He plays everything great, and he can write, and they wrote some great stuff together. The Sis Draper songs are really, really cool. But, you know, he championed my songs. He would tell people, you can see it in Heartworn Highways. He goes, I'm doing the Mercenary song, and somebody's talking over here. He says, listen to this song, you know, and that's, I didn't see that till years later, you know, because that was all extra footage, and, mm-hmm. you know, so I was probably, when I saw that, you know, I was a 50-year-old seeing my 20-year-old self, you know, so that's Christmas Eve 1975 that you're looking at there. So.
Damn. What was the, going into that, what were you thinking was going to happen with that film, or what was, you know, you're just...
I don't know that I had any faith that anything would ever happen with the film. The film came out, you know, like... 6 years later or something like that. And I wasn't anywhere in it when the original theatrical version, neither was Hyatt, neither was a lot of people. But it, you know, I was aware. I can remember when I was even a little younger, like just got to Nashville 19 and Richard Dobson, who is a great songwriter. He's gone now, but, in fact, he and Susanna wrote Old Friends, which mm-hmm. is on this album. Richard was tending bar at Bishop's Pub the night that I met Guy. And, you know, I walked in and he said, "Guy's in the back room." And you know, because he knew that's what I came to Nashville for, was to meet Guy. And I asked him one time, because Richard wrote a book called Gulf Coast Boys, which is Towns figures into it, a lot of the people in this. It sort of fits into, it's sort of a companion piece to Heartworn Highways and, mm-hmm. And the memoir I'm writing now. And, but he, I asked him, just being a kid, and he was way older than I was. He was in his mid or late 30s by that time. He was older than Guy. Guy was 33 when I met him. I was 19. I think Richard was 36. And we seemed ancient and venerable at the time. And I said, will there be, you know, we were talking about a book about something, some book about, you know, I said, well, there, it's the first time I realized I was in the salon.
Yeah.
You know, that this was like a like Paris in the 20s or something, that all these people had arrived here at this one time, and it was a cut above what had happened in Nashville before. It was something that had never, there were always groups of songwriters and they were smart. You know, the group before that was probably the guys that wrote for Pamper Music and a few people they knew, like Willie Nelson, Hank Cochran. Those guys were all smart. Some of them were college educated. Loudermilk certainly was, you know. But so there were always smart guys that wrote the better songs in Nashville. But we were all post Bob Dylan songwriters. We'd all come out of coffee houses. That was the difference. And because we followed Chris Christopherson there.
Yeah.
And he came out of coffee houses. So, you know, it's that thing of I asked, I said, well, do you think there'll be a book about us? And Richard, no hesitation, said, absolutely. There'll be lots of books about us. And he was right.
Yeah.
You know, it was the first time it occurred to me that I was in the middle of something maybe historic. You know, and it is, and it's not historic to everybody in the context of the world, but to certain people that, you know, that care about some kinds of music, it's a big deal that I was part of.
And did you and Guy hit it off right from the start, from that first bar?
Yeah, meeting? I mean, he basically was shooting pool. I walked in, Richard said, "Guy's in the back." So I go back there, and there was a pool room in the back of Bishop's. And I had this cowboy hat. Nobody would have recognized me without just this black Americans, the brand name. I don't think they make them anymore. Just felt cowboy hat with a beaded hat band. And it had been beat to hell because I'd hitchhiked, you know, all over the Southwest with it. And I got in, kind of slunk into a corner and sat there and watched him shoot pool. And then he was lining up a shot, and I was right in. I wasn't in the way of the shot, but I was in his line of sight. And he looked up at me through those eyebrows, and he said, "Nice hat." And that started the conversation. And he found out that I knew Towns, and I started getting invited to stuff. So he literally harassed his publisher until he signed me. Wow. Just absolutely made his life miserable for 6 months until he just signed me just to get Guy to shut up, I think.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
And did you fancy yourself being a bass player back then?
No, I played bass one other time for about 30 seconds in a power trio with that my uncle had, just because his bass player was in jail. And I did it, you know, a couple of rehearsals with him in one gig, and it was decided I wasn't going to do it anymore. I didn't ever own an electric guitar until I was 27 or 28 years wow. old, you know, because my dad wouldn't let me have one. I wanted to sound like Jimi Hendrix or, you know, I listened to the Beatles and the Stones, but my dad wouldn't let me have an electric guitar. I couldn't make my guitar sound like that. So I started gravitating towards the more acoustic Beatles songs and Stone songs. And then eventually there was a lot of other purely acoustic music, you know. Crosby, Stills, and Nash and those records came out when I was a freshman in high school. And I started backtracking from that stuff to the earlier Bob Dylan records. Mm-hmm. And my drama teacher in high school gave me my first copy of the Freewheeling Bob Dylan. And that was a mind blower, because that was the first idea of what a great guitar player Bob Dylan was, and what a great singer Bob Dylan was. Cause that was sort of had become, not that I don't, I mean, my first Bob Dylan record is probably Highway 61, you know, firsthand, and I had to backtrack from there. But not that I don't love that record and the way he sings. The fastest way to end an association with me is to be one of those people that say that Bob Dylan can't sing. That's about the most ignorant thing that anybody can hold.
Yeah.
It's an ignorant and dangerous view, in my opinion.
Yeah. So what was your guitar of choice back in the day when you moved from Houston to
Choice had very little to do with it. It blows my mind what kids are able to come up with now, the quality of acoustic guitar that you can get for a reasonable amount of money compared to the market now and the market then. My first acoustic guitar was a Suzuki, and it was a Japanese-made, not very well-made, slot head, pretty narrow at the fretboard, but it sounded okay. It had like a back-loaded, you know, like bridge, just holes, you know, straight through the bridge, you know, that so it loaded from the back almost like, you know, like a Telecaster or something. But it was wood with a probably a plastic saddle, you know. I don't know. No way it was bone. And I had it. My brother got mad at me and put it on a chair and put his foot on it and broke it right at the heel. My dad just put a bunch of Elmer's glue on it, and somehow it still played in tune. So I played it for another couple of years. My uncle gave it to me. He played left-handed.
Okay.
And he got a 12-string. And I had started learning to play upside down. And but then he moved out of the house, and he had gotten a 12-string for Christmas, and he gave me the Suzuki. And when it was suggested to me I turn the strings around, things got a lot easier, you know. And that was when I was 12, and then so things progressed quite a bit from there. But my guitar playing, you know, got better over the next few years, and probably didn't get any better until I was in, you know, my 40s. You know, really after I got sober. Something happened that I fingerpicked a little, but I don't know what happened. But I just, when I got out of jail and started all over again, just the process of writing those first songs that I wrote, I realized that I had this thing fingerpicking that I had sort of had all along, but I'd never been really recorded it. Because Guitar Town, by the time I started making records, you know, that was me beating the hell out of a big Gibson acoustic, you know, as a rhythm guitar player. And then when I played electric, I just put heavy strings on it. And, you know, I did that on a few songs. But all along, my songwriting process was finger-style guitar, even though I didn't perform that way very much. Hmm. But my melodies were derived from sitting around playing finger-style. And I have a strange primitive style. It's Mississippi John Hurt or it's one finger, you know, and now a thumb pick. I used to do it with just my thumb, but there's a thing that happens when you don't have the second or third finger falling in. The cycle has to wait for that finger again. And there's a hole in the rhythm that's kind of interesting. So, you know, when I would play that way, and I also did the Glen Campbell thing of holding a flat pick and finger picking with my, you know, with my middle finger, you know, which is what Glenn did most of the time. And, you know, I didn't realize that's what I was doing. It was just sort of what I figured out. So my guitar playing just, I don't know, for some reason took this quantum leap in my 40s, and I'm pretty proud of my guitar playing at this point in my life. You know, yeah. It's one of those things. I've kind of learned to do a couple of things fairly well. Just recently, you know, never think that you're everything you're going to be when you're 20 years old, 30 years old, 40 years old. I'm 64 years old. I suddenly overcame at 60 my fear of Fender Telecasters.
All right.
You know, I become a Tele guy, which I never thought I would ever be. It's a very unforgiving electric guitar. And I must have got, my only explanation is I must play better than I used to because I'm pretty comfortable on it. The other thing I like that I didn't like before, which seems like the antithesis of that, are humbucking pickups. I mean, real PAFs are, have a thing. And I'm kind of, my thing now live is, or Trussarts for the, I've got two Trussarts with Arcane Bucker in the front and Arcane Flat Pole Tele pickup in the back. And it's a pretty great combination. It wow. bounces out pretty well. And with that guitar, I don't have to carry more than an electric guitar and a backup for an electric guitar. If I'm doing some open G stuff, I'll carry a third guitar for open G. And that's pretty much it. And the Trussarts, I have packed up Trussart Telecasters at the end of tours and put them in the case and got them out for the next touring cycle at the first rehearsal, and they were still in tune. I swear to God, it's yeah. the most stable electric guitar. I'm a Fender. I'm not too much of a luthier guy, not too much of a, you know, I like some cool off-brand guitars. I like Chicago guitars, and I've got some of those in my collection, but overall I'm a Fender Gibson, you know, Martin,
yeah,
you know, guy. And I don't, a few Rickenbackers, a few Gretches. Gretches, the only vintage pieces I let go when I had to let some guitars go a year ago were I let go of all the Gretches except one. And one of them I regret. I had a Country Club Green 57, you know, like, a 57, it was Country Club in Cadillac Green.
Yeah,
and which was I regret that because you don't see them that often. You don't see, you know, country clubs that much, and but I've got the one I like the best, I've got a 64 6120 double cut, and that's kind of my favorite Gretsch anyway. But I play, and I had a Tennessean, I had a 64 Tennessean, just exactly like the one, you know, the help guitar. And but I let all those go, and like I just kept the 6120 double cut. But mostly, you know, I got a 55 Tele. I've got this intact, still original wiring. Yeah. You know, hasn't been touched. I got a 61 Strat, which is my kind of Strat slab fretboard. Stratocasters are kind of my thing. I want a good 50 Strat one of these days just to have it, but I like rosewood fretboards better yeah. than I do maple fretboards. Generally, the Trussarts have rosewood fretboards on them. You know, I'm not crazy about maple fretboards, and I'm really not crazy about ebony fretboards because they both have in common that they seem a little brittle sounding to me. Mm-hmm. You know, under your fingers when you do. I do a lot of pull offs and stuff, and you know, you hear them more. They say, and it seems cold and a little unyielding. You know, and it's just, you know. It all boils down to what it sounds like from in front of the guitar, which you can't really hear anyway. That's the thing about acoustic guitar. You don't really know what your acoustic guitar hears like, sounds like till you hand it to somebody else to play, and you still don't know.
Yeah.
Because every player sounds different on an instrument. So it's just one of those things.
I wasn't going to get into the whole guitar collection conversation just yet, but since you went there, I'll go there. Do you have any idea how many guitars you have right now?
I'm counting again. I had 200 and some 50 or 60, but it's 135 or 40 now.
Okay.
That's counting mandolins and banjos, and I do count those. You know, I got rid of a lot of cool amps, and I have a few regrets there. I decided better to keep guitars than amps. I kept the two amps I use in the studio, which are an AC50 head that I bought from Charlie Sexton when he decided not to use them on the road anymore. He had two, and he could decide he could let go of one, so I bought it. It was the main amp that he had out with Bob all the first his whole first tenure in Bob's band. I've got that, and I've got a Scumbag cabinet that I had made for that head. Scumbag cabinets are really cool because he makes a cabinet that you can, with the back is hinged, so that you can open it completely up, or you can close it, or you can actually tune it, which comes in handy if you're in a studio that with limited isolation and you're putting it in a box, moving that back around and finding a sweet spot really makes a big difference on how it sounds in a in a isolated enclosure like that. And the Scumbag speakers sound great. Then I've got a 59 Bassman, and you know, I use one of those two amps pretty much. The blues record Terraplane, I put that Bassman in a box. I played all the guitar, I played through it, same setting, and the harp, I played through the same damn amp, same settings, didn't even touch it, didn't even take it out of the box. Just had the harp mic running through one channel and the guitar running through one channel. I just picked up one, picked up the other, and never touched it. Just turned it off and on at the beginning of the day, every day. The last record, the Telecaster, I kind of like the AC50. It sounds, you know, a little bit more like, you know, they're not... You know, the Vox Class A thing, because that's not what they are. You know, they're the Forerunner of Plexis and you know, power, you know, 50-watt push-pull circuit amps. And I like 50 watts and 410s. That's what I like. And I did give up a Blackface Super that I do regret, you know. And one Gibson Ranger, but Pete Townsend got it, so so that's not too bad.
What was used on the Guy record? What acoustics did you use?
Acoustic, a 1935 D28. It's the only acoustic I used on the whole record.
That's a good guitar if you got to use
one. It's a great guitar. I've got a great one. I got it from Christy and Walter. It was on, it was a consignment guitar. I paid it on, you know, out on layaway basically because it was a lot of money. It's a great guitar. The difference is, it's beginning with the first record I used it on was So You Want to Be an Outlaw. I have a lot of really cool small body Martin guitars. And usually, what I would do is I would use a Dreadnought, one of the big Gibson, or you know, I had a good 39 D18, and it became kind of my main guitar when I wanted that vibe when I was playing rhythm on a country song or anything bluegrassy, obviously. But when it came to finger picking, I had an 021. And I had a 0021. One was like a wartime guitar. One was a pre-war guitar. And I used one of those two guitars on everything on the three or four records before that for anything. Or I have an L00 that pops up. I got a CF100, a 51 CF100. Those things can be really dodgy, but I have a really good one. And it's everybody that plays it tries to buy it. It just sounds, it's a great fingerstyle guitar. But that D28, you know, most of the time when I'm finger picking like that, I've got a capo up at least the second fret and usually higher, and I just capo it up, and it for some reason sounds like a perfectly balanced small body guitar, and it's got plenty of boom when you take it off. I use 13s on it. I don't ever lighten up the strings on it. I keep it detuned when it's not being played like I do with most of the old stuff, but those things were built for 13s. There's no reason not to put 13s on them. You know, bluegrass guys used to shoot screws, you know, into it. But it was basically because they were using, you know, heavy strings. Del McCree uses a 60-gauge E string. So they were going, you know, beyond the decimal point when it came to how. Because they just wanted them to stay in tune. And they were trying to be heard, you know, over a banjo for one thing, you know. And the singer stood in the middle, but you know. There, he had to kind of like struggle with other people for a spot, you know. So that's why, when I made a bluegrass record, we did the tour with one mic. That's what we did, you know, because that's what the McCurries were doing at the time when I made the record with them. And it's how I learned to play bluegrass. And I've still never played bluegrass in front of an audience any other way except for, you know, five guys around one mic.
Yeah.
So, but it's, I just used the D28 for everything on this last record. There wasn't any reason to use anything out. I used the Telecaster for everything except for Parking Lot, and that is a pretty recent acquisition. I've got a 63 Les Paul, the SG thing with the side vibrola. That's incredible. And it was the first real, you know, Alnico, you know, before they started overwinding them buckers I'd ever owned in a guitar. And it was a mind blower. It was a life-changing thing. And it started, I've got a really good 2011 custom shop Les Paul, and it started to make me want to try to find some different pickups for that guitar, because that's the one thing place where they stopped. The custom shop guitars from 11 and 12, you know, 10, 11, 12, and they are great. They have bumblebees, you know, they're all hide glue. They weigh what they should weigh. They're, you know, they're all under 8 pounds somewhere, you know, in that range. But they still, because kids would get them off the wall in the music store and they weren't selling if they underwound the pickups the way that they're supposed to be. And you should be able to play Buckaroo on the back pickup on a Gibson Les Paul. And it's not sound fundamentally different from a Fender Telecaster, except that it won't hum.
Yeah.
And that really should be the only difference. But everybody, you know, when they drop, my theory is that when they dropped the Alnico in 64 and, you know, went to the ceramic magnets, they were missing something. And they started compensating for that by adding more windings. And the guys that started playing them later in the 60s and early in the 70s, you know, started hot rodding pickups, and the standard got lost along the way. So it's kind of hard to find anything. I finally settled on a couple. I got a pair of new, they just added them to the line. I like the Arcane pickups, but I've got throwbacks, the lowest impedance, you know, Bucker pair that they make. They just came out with this 57. They call it something. It's based on a pair that came out of a 57 gold top. But I, you know, I had a lot of guitars to compare it to now. I had my own 63.
Yeah.
There's no difference between, you know, that I can hear between any PAF pickup and any patent number pickup before they get rid of the Alnico magnets. They all sound pretty much the same, and the gain structure is pretty much the same.
Do you work on the guitars yourself?
No, no. I don't ever. I don't trust myself with a soldering iron. I've got lots of guys that I know that are really good. You know, Tom Crandall is the only person that ever works on my acoustic guitars. Electric guitars, I'm not quite as persnickety about. And actually, Alex does most of my electric guitar stuff, you know, Tom's partner.
Yeah.
Because he builds nice Telecasters, and he's pretty good at that stuff. So, and then the guys in Christy and Walter's shop in Nashville work on my stuff, too, because, you know, my collection lives both places.
And
the road guitars are kind of a separate set of guitars from the guitars I use in the studio. There's almost nothing I use on the road that I use, except for my main mandolin. Which is, I've got the one I use in the studio most of the time. I got recently, so it's kind of replaced one mandolin. I have an A style, an A junior Gilchrist that, I've had three Gilchrist mandolins over the years. I had a Sunburst that was, that I got when we were making the Mountain. Ronnie owned it before me. It was a parallel brace, you know, traditional. It was a great mandolin, and, it got sold for a ridiculous amount of money. So it's sold for $30,000. I already had another Gilchrist that I actually like better. I've got this A Junior that just barks, and I've got a pickup in it. That's the, you know, it's harder to come up with a cheaper mandolin than it is a cheaper guitar. And I can carry the mandolin on the plane.
Yep.
So I don't have to worry about it getting thrown around. So I use the same mandolins in the studio that I do on the road. That's about the only place where that takes place. Because a lot of it's about solo tours. I'm flying a lot. You know, stuff like this, professor, I'm flying a lot. So I use good cases. I put them in calls and cases.
Yep.
And I pray. And I don't check anything that can't be replaced if the goons break it. Because I have had some stuff broken over the years.
Sure. For a while, maybe this was just marketing speak, but when your signature model, Martin, came out, it sounded like you were hanging out at Umanoff's shop when it was still around a lot.
I absolutely hung out there all the time. I lived on Jones Street right behind it.
So what's your, do you have a hangout spot now? Is it T.R. Crandall's?
Well, the problem is T.R. Crandall, when I hang out in the guitar shop, it's usually there, but it's on the other side of town. I hang out at Walter and Christie's more just because when I'm in Nashville fairly often, my mom's there, you know, you know, John Henry, my son's mother's moving back there full time. He's with me in New York 9 months of the year, and he's there in the summertime, and I tour in the summer. That's what's going to happen after this tour. This tour is going to run April to Labor Day, basically. And then after that, I'm only going to tour in the summertime from now on out. I'm going to spend 9 months of the year concentrating on theater in New York, and John Henry will stay there and go to school there. My little boy has autism, and so he needs a really good school that he's in New York City, and it's just a matter of, and he's getting bigger, and it kind of needs to be my shift.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. He's pretty big boys. He's nine, and he's getting, my other boys are both big too, so I know how big he's going to get.
Yeah, so, I understand. You said theater though. What are you going to be doing?
I've already written music for an off-Broadway piece at Soho Rep, that a Richard Maxwell play, and I ended up getting tricked into being that as an actor, and that was fucking terrifying. But I'm doing music. It's actually going to be the core of my next record. I'm doing music for a piece that's going up at the Public Theater in 2020. Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen wrote the book. It's not really a musical. It's a play with music. The songs are all mine, and the songs sort of propel the narrative along. And it's called Coal Country. It's about a coal mine that blew up in West Virginia called Upper Big Branch. I got Don Blankenship that you saw that couldn't string a sentence together that ran for the Senate in West Virginia. It was his mine. He ran it outlaw every minute from the time that he bought it from Peabody Coal. And he finally killed the L25 guys that were in it just because he considered the fines and you know, the citations for operating illegally and unsafely to be part of his business model. And he finally killed all those guys. And he went to jail for it, but he got the maximum penalty for murdering those 25 guys was a year and a $250,000 fine. They were taking $85,000 worth of coal out of that mine every single day, way they were running it. And that's anthracite. That's like high quality steel making coal. Now, where do you reckon that's going? We don't make steel in the United States. Every bit of it was going to China.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, just where we're at. The idea that what's wrong with the schools is unions and you know, and the teachers, it's not, it's funding. And what's wrong with the, you know, with the jobs, where did the jobs go? They went to machines. And every other country in the world, unions are part of a fundamental component of democracy and part of working people's voice and things. And what unions did when they started to the machines started taking the jobs away, which started happening a long time ago in Europe, as they started becoming part of how people dealt with that and insisted that the government, you know, the unions have power, and they insisted that the government try to, what do we do with these people? How do we keep these people working? How do we retrain them? And that's happened to some degree, you know, everywhere else in the world. It hasn't happened at all here. And that's why we're in the shape that we're in right now.
Yeah. So could more theater writing be on the horizon?
Oh yeah. No, that's what I moved to. I moved to New York largely to breathe the same air as Tony Kushner. I love theater. It's one of my, I mean, I spend money on, I don't go out and see that much music. I do, you know, I'm as far as music for my own consumption, I'll go to the Station Inn when I'm in Nashville. I like bluegrass probably better than I do anything else, just for me to go listen to music or jazz. I go see, there's a lot of great jazz in New York, and I'm kind of old-fashioned about jazz. I like piano players and saxophone players, but, you know, the Blue Note's two blocks away, and the Vanguard's, you know, a quarter mile away, so I see a lot of stuff. I've seen Ron Carter about six times in the last 3 years,
nice.
That's a pretty great thing about living in New York. But, you know, I don't I spend money on theater, mm-hmm. and baseball. That's what I
did.
Oh, Yankees all my life.
All right.
Yeah, because I mean, I grew up in Texas before we had baseball. So you were either a Yankees fan or a Dodgers fan, because that's who was on. The game of the week was the Yankees or the Dodgers and whoever, because they were the only two stadiums that were wired for sound. It was Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese. And my granddad was a Yankees fan, so I never had a chance. Yeah. Got my first transistor radio for the 61 World Series.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mentioned before we started recording, you have a bunch of 19th century Martins.
I do.
Make it to record?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They did before I got the fucking D20A. it's kind of hard to put that thing up once I get it out of the case. On Towns, on Pancho and Lefty.
Yep.
And To Live Is to Fly. That's like a 1890. Probably 91, 92. Hard to tell because the serial number started in 98, I believe.
Okay.
So it's a pre-serial number, but it's a 90s guitar. It's size 1 Martin. So 126, we think, because it's been fucked with a little bit. It was a guitar that Matt Umanoff put together for a girl in the village years and years and years ago, and she decided to sell it in a C2 conversion that he made, and I bought both guitars.
Wow!
And the C2 conversion, not because Matt built it himself. You know, it's like it's a C2 body with a neck that Matt made, and you know, it's a short scale guitar. Matt's real innovation. The M guitars are based on an innovation that Matt deserves credit for. People were making conversions of Martins, taking, you know, mainly the F size, but some of the C size guitars. If you converted a C size guitar, you know, you got you know, like basically a triple O out of the deal. But if you converted an F, you got a size Martin guitar that had never existed before, because they were designed to be, you know, 16-inch archtop guitars. They didn't have carved backs. They didn't have a lot of other. They didn't have a raised fretboard. They had several other things that kept them from sounding as good as Gibson's. It's the one thing that Martin ever didn't do as well as Gibson was build. Well, mandolins and archtop guitars. Those are the only two things. And otherwise, Martins are better guitars than Gibsons across the board when it comes to just playing on American flat tops. But he had kind of a basket case. And there was some, I don't know whether there was something wrong or whether he just came up with the idea of this is a big guitar. It needs to have a long scale neck. He built a new neck and a new top for a back and side set that David Bromberg owned. Mm-hmm. And that's what that M42, you know, reissue that they did. I had one of those for a while. I sold it when I sold a lot of the custom shop stuff. But that's where the modern M guitar comes from. It's long scale, you know. And I don't know. You could have arrived at it. You could have taken a neck off of an early OM, you know, with a long scale neck. You could have done that. But those are pretty rare. Nobody wanted the arch top, so nobody cared whether people cannibalized them or not. The people that started to bitch about it. But I own a C2, an intact C2. I don't have an F, but I have a conversion. I have a conversion that Tom Crandall and Matt built that was made from a 35, you know, F9. The back, Matt and myself and Tom Crandall went to Martin, picked out a neck blank, picked out the top. You know, they let us do that because it was when, you know, it was Dick was still there then. this was, you know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago. So, and it's turned out to be an incredible guitar. It's just starting to really wake up now because it's, I don't get to play it enough, but because I've got other guitars that are older and already sound great, you know, so. But it's beautiful.
We got to see this guitar collection. We got to get you in the magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. I got a bunch of them. You know, they're pretty fucking photogenic.
Where do most of them live? In New York?
Most of them are in Nashville because I have more. I keep the best stuff in New York when I'm there.
Yeah.
Like, but what ends up having to happen because I don't. If I have room on the bus and it's the right time of year, it's not the dead of winter, then I can throw some on and bring them. Or if I'm touring solo on a bus. But most of the time, what has to happen is Brian will have to load them up, you know, in a van and get a co-driver and just drive them nonstop from Nashville to New York or from New York to Nashville. And I used to do it all the time when I had a house in Woodstock at one point.
Yeah.
And then the collection was there. I built a room there specifically for it, but that went, you know, away in the divorce, that house. And so maybe one of these days I'll have a place closer to keep the rest of the guitars. But right now, the bulk of the collection is in Nashville. I'm there enough that doesn't bother me all that much. But when I come off the road for a period, right now, everything, the D28, the DeQuisto, all that stuff's in Nashville because I made the Guy record in September. And I was on the road until, I'm still on the road. And until there's a long break, which will be in September, they'll stay there. And then in September, when I come off the road for 9 months, I'll probably move all the best stuff to my apartment.
Yeah,
and then the rest of it, I'll continue to live in Tennessee.
You mentioned the DeQuisto, but I don't think on the record we heard about that. What was it?
It's a DeQuisto, like it's the last, as far as I know, the last New Yorker special, which was one of the old man D'Angelico's patterns. That it's a 17-inch. It's natural. It's an incredible archtop guitar. Mm-hmm. It's one of those ones that you go. The first time I picked up a DeQuisto, D'Angelico's, especially, there's a guitar, Walter Carter's, that I lust after. It's like a Style B, I think, from the 30s. Those are the old man's great guitars, the non-cutaway 17-inch and 16-inch guitars from the 30s are incredible. But this guitar, it was another DeQuisto that I played in Matt's shop one time, and I went, oh, I never had any interest in archtop guitars, but I played that guitar and I went, oh, this is what this is supposed to be like.
Yeah.
And I started playing DeQuistos and D'Angelicos. I started, you know, just, there's places that have those things and you don't see them that often. Tom Crandall is an archtop guy. That's what he plays and what he does. So they've started getting them, and you can. That's not a bad place to start looking. Of course, there's, you know, one place to go if you're really looking for a D'Angelico, especially, you know. And But I don't, I just don't, you know, it was something I got into relatively late, but it's, it was Matt's guitar. He ordered it. It was made for him.
Yep.
And, it's, he decided to sell it. And, he'd always said he would call me first, and he did. And I scrambled and put the money together, and I paid. It was the most money I'd paid for a guitar up to that point. And it's still, I've never played an archtop guitar that's as close to as good as this one is.
Yeah. Has that shown up on a record?
Oh, yeah. It's on a lot of records. Okay. Me playing it or somebody else playing it. It's on, it's on stuff on The Low Highway on that record. Okay. I played on a couple of tracks. And also on So You Want to Be an Outlaw, Chris plays it on at least one or two tracks. And let's see, Chris Clark, who was in the band at the time, plays it on, I think, three tracks on Outlaw, just playing sock guitar. Because, you know, we made that more like a traditional country record. Richard Bennett produced it, and he's really into those old records. And he thinks there ought to be, you know, sock guitar on everything. It's just somebody playing like a straight comp rhythm all the way through everything. And that guitar, it barks. It's real. But it's really way more complicated. I like 16-inch archtops that kind of bark like good mandolins do. But this is a guitar I don't really deserve. But it sounds incredible. I'll tell you where you can hear it on Guy is Gary Nicholson plays it on Old Friends.
Yeah.
He plays it on his solo on Old Friends. Played on that guitar.
I love that all these things are getting played.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I'm getting as much as possible. What my routine is when I go home, like I haven't been home for more than 10 days in the last 2 years. And when I get home, I'll get, like I've already done the J200, put new strings on it, put it out on a stand, play it for a couple of days, then detune it, put it back up. When I get home, I'm going to get the L00 out. Mm-hmm. There's a Roy Schmidt conversion that's been sitting there. It's been tuned to open G. It's actually that Joni Mitchell tuning, open G with a C bass. Because the last time I used it was on a song that Sean Colvin and I wrote for the Colvin and Earl record. And I don't know, I think I'm going to let it live in that open tuning, because those things were, they were built to be Hawaiian guitars. And when you get them into a low tuning like that, they just seem to really shine. There's something about it, and it's a killer radio grand conversion that Tom Crandall built, and I think he's doing the best conversions on those guitars that I've ever seen.
Yeah,
you know, they're pretty amazing. He's also converting Chicago guitars, you know, and I own, I'll tell you the other thing I own, I have the only intact extant Marshall Special that exists, which is, there are two that are known to exist, and the other ones, whoever owns it decided to heat treat the neck and forgot that the fretboard was made of you know, celluloid, and it just curled up and vanished from the planet. So Tom owned this one, and I bought it and the that L10. You know, I have a Gibson L10 that belonged to Tom too,
and when, okay,
they kept them on the wall. They'd been promised to me for years. And I finally, when they'd been in the, Tom and Alex had the shop open maybe 9 months or something like that, I finally picked those guitars up, because they wanted them on the wall until I paid for them. I was just scared they'd forget or something. So I went ahead and found the money somehow, even though I wasn't really supposed to be buying any guitars. I was in the middle of a divorce and I wasn't supposed to be buying anything.
Are you back to buying now?
I've just started buying a little bit again. Yeah. Okay. I bought a killer, well, I hit a slot machine for $10,000 in Kansas City. And
literally a slot machine?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
all right.
I called Walter and I said, you know that Firebird I was playing? Get it off the wall now. And I bought a killer 64, you know, like Firebird 3, you know, just a dot Firebird, but with the vibro, everything's still there. It's incredible. And Johnny Winter signed the pick guard at some point,
nice,
you know, when the other guy owned it. So that I need to find a duplicate pick guard. That's one going to be next one of my off the road projects, just to have it, because I'm going to play it, and I don't want to put that up in the case, you know, just to put it away. I bought that. I bought what else did I buy? Oh, I bought a new Trusart for this tour. I bought another. My deal with the Trusarts is the what is it called? Is it B15? Is that the Bigsby with the raised pickup position? I think that's the name of that model. Yeah. That, see, I thought that was some kind of new jack thing, and I thought Keith Richards was the first guy to ever put a bucker on the front of a you know, of a Telecaster, but it wasn't. It was Bob Bain, and he had exactly the setup that I have now: a bucker in the front, a B15 tremolo, and there's something about a flat pole tele pickup in a B15 tremolo, because it's isolated, it's sitting up in that big piece of aluminum, and it's way closer than the strings than you can ever get it if it's mounted in the body. So it makes a big difference, and it's the two pickups balance better, and the neck has to be set at a radically different angle, so it becomes kind of another beast. But I got another one of those, a black one. I've got a seafoam green one I've had for, I don't know, 7 years, something like that. It was one of those guitars that James showed up at a gig in L.A., and his business model is show up at a gig, give you a guitar, put it in your hands, and they send you a bill for it.
Yep.
That's what
he does. It's a common move.
I bought a couple of guitars like that from him. So,
it clearly works.
This one I actually bought on Reverb. It was in a shop,
and
they wanted way too much money. I was going to buy it from James's site, and then it disappeared, and I went, oh, fuck, I waited too long. I was thinking about it, and then it's the same thing. It's rust over cream. With the rose, with the rose engraved pick guards. The one I've got is Paisley's on the seafoam green thing over where I think it's red. He puts those things over just to it wears out at the edges. Yeah. And but they're great. They're ridiculously heavy.
Yeah.
But because of the steel, my theory is they just kind of sing, and they have more sustain than most Tellys do. If you drive them a little bit harder, they'll kind of do anything, and they stay intense. That's a great, great road guitar.
Yeah. Steve, I feel like we've barely scratched the surface, but I know you got to run, and we got to follow up. We got to get you in the magazine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Final question. Was it a quarter slot machine or a dollar slot machine?
It's a dollar slot machine, but the bet was more like 10.
Oh, you got to do the all credits?
You're wasting your time if you do anything but the maximum bet on any slot machine.
All right. Are you a slot guy?
When I gamble, I'm an antisocial gambler. I sit at dollar slots by myself and prepared to lose $1,000, $2,000, because that's the only way you're ever going to win anything.
All right.
And I do it when I play a casino most of the time. But we had a day off in Kansas City, and I'd been on kind of a roll. I'd run $5,500 at this Indian casino about 10 days before. And then, I haven't run anything since. But I was like, it was this little bitty shitty casino in downtown KC, and I'll never forget it. I won it. I called Walter, told him to take that guitar off the wall. And then I was determined to go to Gates and get some barbecue. And I said, I put the money in an envelope, so I'm going to go to Gates and get some. Or no, I went to Arthur Bryant's to get burnt ends. That's what I did. And my driver went with me because he was nervous about me running around with all that money. But I didn't want to go back and take it back to the hotel because I was hungry.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Awesome. Thanks. We'll be right back.